From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Friday is the 200th anniversary of the storming of the Bastille. On today's Fresh Air, we look back at the French Revolution with historian Simon Chama, author of the new book Citizens. He says he's returned violence to the center of the story because violence was the revolution. Also today, Rick Bass talks about his life of solitude writing in a cabin high in the Montana wilderness. Bass's new book chronicles the years he spent as a geologist drilling for oil. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers some of the glitter rock bands of the 70s, and book critic John Leonard reviews New York Times correspondent Thomas Friedman's account of his years covering the Middle East from Beirut to Jerusalem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush flew to Hungary today after meeting earlier in Gdansk, Poland, with Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa. The president stood with Wałęsa at his side to deliver an emotional speech to tens of thousands of flag-waving Solidarity supporters. Bush arrived in Budapest in a driving rain at dusk and pledged to a welcoming crowd that the United States wants to work with Hungary to continue the changes and the reform taking place in that country.
No one now denies that reform is the path of the future. In nation after nation, decades of experience have proven beyond any doubt the poverty of an idea, the idea that progress is the product of the state. On the contrary, progress is the product of the people. And state control simply cannot provide sustained economic growth.
In a toast at a state dinner tonight, Bush repeated the words of confidence and support he sounded in Poland, telling his Hungarian hosts the road ahead will be difficult. Hungarian Prime Minister Miklos Nemeth says Hungary's economic problems cannot be solved without Western support. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney today promised to improve civilian oversight of arms purchases. Pressured by an arms procurement scandal and a cost-cutting Congress, Cheney announced a new program to help control the nation's $300 billion military budget. He refused to predict how many jobs might be lost in the efficiency drive, but he said it would take years to revamp the Pentagon's weapons buying system. Cheney said his goal is to save $30 billion a year by 1993. Housing Secretary Jack Kemp answered questions on Capitol Hill today on the growing scandal surrounding his agency and its cost to the nation. NPR's Mara Liasson has details.
Kemp got a very warm welcome from the House Employment and Housing Subcommittee today. He was uniformly praised for his aggressive efforts to steer the troubled agency out of what is now commonly referred to as a swamp of abuses. Kemp told the committee that he is taking steps to fix a long list of problems at HUD. He said he instituted new management and accounting procedures and a new code of ethics. He's also cooperating with the Justice Department on hundreds of criminal investigations. In response to concerns that the massive problems at HUD would be used as an excuse to gut the agency's programs, Kemp went out of his way to assure the committee that HUD's commitment to low and moderate income people is intact. He said he wants to wage war on poverty, not programs. The cost to the taxpayers for the cleanup at HUD has been estimated to be $4 billion or more. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
The National Labor Relations Board said today the Pittston Coal Company is guilty of unfair labor practices that led the United Mine Workers of America to go on strike. The 17-page complaint means Pittston will not be allowed to hire permanent workers to replace striking union members. This is NPR in Washington. Chrysler Corporation today joined the NAACP's Fair Share program. Chrysler signed an agreement to double the number of minorities and women in executive management positions to 20% of its workforce within 5 years. The commitment was signed as part of the NAACP's annual meeting in Detroit. Testimony in the trial of two former PTL aides continued in Charlotte, North Carolina today, with allegations of widespread misuse of ministry funds. Today's proceedings revealed that David Taggart, one of PTL founder Jim Baker's top aides, took more cash advances from the ministry funds than Baker did. Ellie Boudreau of member station WFAE reports.
In today's testimony, former PTL Vice President Peter Bailey said that $10,000 cash advances were common and that Taggart refused to document how the money was spent. Taggart was Bailey's boss, and Bailey said he simply had to accept Taggart's word that the money was used for PTL business. In other testimony, Baker's former secretary, Shirley Fulbright, said yesterday that she occasionally signed Baker's name without his knowledge to payment authorizations for David Taggart and his brother James. James Taggart was on the PTL payroll as the ministry's interior decorator. The brothers are on trial for tax evasion. Federal prosecutors also alleged that they used more than $1 million in PTL money to cover their own expenses. The trial is expected to last through much of July. For National Public Radio, I'm Ellie Boudreau in Charlotte, North Carolina.
15 South Pacific nations today asked for help to force Japan and Taiwan to end the practice of drift net fishing. Cook Islands Prime Minister Jeffrey Henry says Pacific leaders are concerned that drift net fishing, also called gill net fishing, is depleting fish stocks and threatening the Pacific's economy. Henry said the Pacific Island nations back an Australian proposal for an international convention banning drift net fishing. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. This Friday is the 200th anniversary of the storming of the Bastille. 2 centuries after the beginning of the French Revolution, historians are still debating what the significance of the revolution really is. One of the historians stirring things up is my guest Simon Chama, author of the new book Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. In his telling of the revolution, society in the reign of Louis XVI was more addicted to change than resistant to it. He sees the revolution as tragic because of its obsession with violence. He calls his book an argument in the form of a story, and he tells the story of the revolution in an almost novelistic way. Even reviewers who have criticized him for neoconservative revisionism have found themselves swept away by his telling of the story. I asked him about that day 200 years ago when hundreds of Parisians, mostly workers, took the Bastille. Chama says the initial aim of the crowd was to get supplies of gunpowder from the Bastille, but after they took the prison, they demolished it because it was a symbol of darkness and secrecy to which the aristocracy held the key. I asked Simon Chama to describe the actual edifice, the Bastille.
It looked extremely alarming, especially to the small shopkeepers and craftsmen, hatters, glovers, cabinet makers who were crowded into the area of the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. You have to imagine a sort of flat, packed area of little shops, and then rising above it at the western end of that area, these huge round towers, sort of 8 round towers, each of them with 5-foot thick walls. There's a wonderful painting by a man called Hubert Robert, who submitted this to a public exhibition in the year of the revolution, which makes these towers look even more vertiginous than they actually were. They're about 75, 80 feet high, I mean, which was pretty high. So if you were trying to imagine a really awful dungeon, I mean, a kind of fortress citadel in the middle of a city, this looked very much like the real thing.
Well, in fact, it was built in the 14th century, right?
Yes, it was really built for military purposes. It was built for military purposes. One should, I'm on the whole of the view that there were plans to knock it down, and it's really generally accepted that it was becoming redundant. However, it should be said it was no Hilton. I mean, there was a time, in the time of Cardinal Richelieu in the early 1600s, when it was a very grim place indeed. I mean, people really were locked up, and the key was thrown away, and they had no hope of getting out. And it was traditionally the place where you could put prisoners of state, and the monarchy could define exactly who it chose to be as prisoners of state. But by the time the revolution broke out, there were really not many people in it at all, and it wasn't really used for these rather sinister purposes.
What were conditions in the Bastille like under Louis XVI?
Well, like that good capitalist society, which I rather bizarrely paint Louis XVI's France to be, depended how rich you were. Not how noble you were, but how rich you were. If you had the money, you could have your own clothes, your own. The Marquis de Sade had his own library, had 3 extremely good meals a day. And many other people who were reasonably well off expected to have their meals brought in. You could go for exercise, walk in the little governor's vegetable garden or around on the parapet there. And there were not really many people who were desperately poor brought in there. A large number of the prisoners at that time were actually locked up by their own family. A historian working on the Bastille records some time ago, discovered that people appealed to the king to lock up members of their own family who were delinquent for one reason or another. And if they were locked up, the Marquis de Sade was locked up by his own wife and family, then the wife and family came to see them, and they were really treated quite well. The infamous parts were the parts immediately under the roof and the parts immediately below ground level, the very top of the tower and the very bottom of the tower. And their conditions were absolutely horrible, but those were the cells which hadn't been used for 20 or 30 years.
My guest is historian Simon Sharma, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. After the fall of the Bastille, heads were paraded around on sticks. Whose heads were they?
Well, they were the heads, in the first place, of the governor of the Bastille, a man called Delaunay. And then there were heads of other officials of the city of Paris, one of whom was responsible for the provisioning of Paris, for the providing of food. One has to remember this is a period of quite desperate hunger. The 14th of July was not just the day on which the Bastille fell, it was the day in which bread prices reached an all-time high, and most people existed on bread. Obviously, I feel sort of troubled about that display of heads, because I try and make a distinction in my book between understandable violence and violence which seems to happen once issues have been decided. I don't think it's at all surprising, in a way, that the crowd should have been very angry, and because they were, after all, extremely hungry. They had been brutalized by the old regime itself for a long time. And there was a certain amount of violence in the change of power in Paris itself. This was the kind of war between units of the army that stayed loyal and units of the army that didn't, and that had taken place on the night of the 12th. The violence which disturbed me more was the violence of punishment, of revenge, of display, the kind of thing when these heads were taken around. It was almost a kind of gloating revenge. There was a terrible moment, for example, when one of these officials, on the 22nd of July, actually, had his body had been mutilated and his head was stuck on a pike. And they managed to arrest his son-in-law, who was fleeing Paris, and brought him back. And they, before they, in fact, strung him up and cut off his head, they poked his father-in-law's head in front of his face and said, "Kiss Papa." And it's that kind of grim, black, rather awful joke, which I think throws a very sort of dark shadow, not just over the revolution, but even over July 89.
Well, you say that you think it's the period just after the fall of the Bastille that created the politics of paranoia.
Yes.
In the French Revolution. Would you give us a brief explanation of what you mean there?
Yes, I do. I mean, let me preface it by saying one shouldn't be too sort of smugly self-congratulatory on this side of the Atlantic about it, because the Atlantic Ocean is a very important difference in exactly this respect. I mean, there was no, as far as I know, no deep worry that really young America was under serious threat from a Canadian invasion. From the very beginning of the revolution, there was a sense that you'd done something very, very daring, or very, very naughty indeed, depending on how guilty you were feeling. And out there, there were people waiting to punish you. And they weren't just indeterminate people. They were the crowned kings of Europe. Marie Antoinette's brother, the Emperor of Austria, who was not a long way away. Belgium was then an Austrian possession. There was the King of Britain, who was just the channel away. Even the King of Spain. So in 1789, there were rumours flying all over the country that the British had landed on the west coast of France, even that there were Prussian units of the Prussian-German army that were about to bomb Paris from Montmartre, and above all, that there was going to be an invasion of Austrian troops from Belgium. So it was this terrible sense that there were enemies within and enemies without. And they seemed to be vindicated by the fact that literally 2 or 3 days after the Bastille fell, the king's youngest brother, Artois, the most reactionary of the brothers, fled the country. So you had this sense of saying, oh God, this is a very porous, fragile, dangerous thing. We must in some sense get them, whoever them are, before they get us. But you're right also to say that I think that it's this period between late July and November, I would say at the latest, which set the mould for revolutionary politics in many ways, some of which I don't feel were altogether healthy for the prospects of freedom. I'm not someone who really wants to criticise the revolution altogether, but I do make a distinction between, let's say, the first half of 1789 and the second half of 1789.
You say that in dealing with violence, historians have erred on the side of the squeamish and that you wanted to return violence to the center of this story. So I want to ask you about the guillotine. We think of it, I think now, as a very violent form of punishment, but in a historical context, you say that this was actually supposed to be an alternative, a more humane alternative to the type of capital punishment that was previously practiced.
Yes, that's right. It starts off, it's one of these ironies of Enlightenment humanitarianism, that it starts off with the best possible intentions, like the revolution itself, and ends up quite differently. No, it was proposed by a man called Dr. Guillotin, Ignace Guillotin, who had already had a reputation as something of a pamphleteer in the Paris elections to the States General. And he stood up very seriously and gave a powerful and passionate speech to the National Assembly, where he said, look, previously, there are two reasons why we should have this machine, as he called it. One is ideological and one is humanitarian. The ideological one is that previously punishments echoed the legal distinctions which had divided people into commoners and nobles. If you were nobles, you were entitled to be beheaded by the sword. This was regarded as the dignified way of meeting your end. If you were a commoner, you were hanged. And if you were very unlucky and had done something very wicked indeed, like tried to attack a member of the royal family, you could be broken on the wheel, bits of you scattered in various directions. So he said, we are all going to be equal. We're all citizens. No matter how criminal the citizen is, everybody should have the same punishment. So the machine, in its kind of implacable equalizing level, was supposed to be a perfect revolutionary symbol. But he said, there's something else. There's another reason why we should have the guillotine, is that it's very humane. Nobody will feel a thing. He used the phrase in French that the guilty party would feel no more than the merest tickle on the back of the neck, after which the head would jump into the basket. Then he stopped, and everybody burst out laughing. I mean, it was a kind of nervous, slightly hysterical laughter. The sort of laughter, I think, when one sees something awful, but something funny. You know, someone fall down and hurt themselves. And poor Guillotin was so dumbfounded at this kind of cackling that he said, oh, forget the whole thing. We'll just not do it. He was very dashed by it. And he did forget the whole thing until 2 or 3 years later, when it was taken up again, essentially as something that was going to be used for criminal justice. But by the time that happened, the leaders of the revolution, some of the most militant leaders of the revolution, like Robespierre, who had actually cast his vote against capital punishment earlier in the revolution, they were deeply worried that the whole process of the revolution was disintegrating into spontaneous bloodshed on the streets. I mean, they were particularly shocked by what happened in the so-called September massacres in 1792. So for these leaders, the key problem was, how can the state take back to itself, in the name of the Republic, the monopoly of violent punishment which the monarchy had once enjoyed? So they took up the guillotine, not as this kind of piece of legal punitive surgery, something that would be done in private, no one watching, and instead the attempt was to try and sort of slake the popular thirst for punishment. So instead of putting it in a field somewhere private, they stuck it right in the middle of what is now the Place de la Concorde, and moreover, facing the pedestal on which the statue of Louis XVI's grandfather, had stood. The statue had been knocked off when the monarchy had fallen in August. When Louis XVI was executed, the first big execution, really, in January 1793, he was stuck through what was called the national window, the little window, stuck through that sort of frame, and made to look at the naked pedestal on which his grandfather had stood. So this kind of theatrical element in the guillotine was really there from the beginning.
This gets us to a question that you think is one of the key questions in the French Revolution, which is, once you've initiated violence, how do you prevent it from working against you instead of for you?
Right. Nobody could figure it out. I mean, the guillotine and the terror, as I just said, was really a way in which the Jacobins, who were the last in a succession of people to be propelled to power by intense anger on the streets, they said, we can't have what they then called anarchy. And Robespierre, again, in his brilliant, rather icy, but really very intellectually, sort of cold-bloodedly impressive way, said, we really have a choice here. On the one hand, we have what he called constitutional government, the government of laws, which is all very nice. Yes, it's true. It's what the Declaration of the Rights of Man stood for. But revolutions, you know, he said to everybody, are not peaceful things. We are fighting a war. We are fighting a war with traitors within and traitors without. We have to have revolutionary government until the peace. What revolutionary government until the peace meant dictatorship. So that instead of the revolution's reason being the rule of law, the revolution's reason, or the reason for revolution government, was now force, was now security, was now the interest of state. And it was in the name of that that the terror was unleashed on tens of thousands of people who came to the guillotine and hundreds of thousands of people who were destroyed by the war in various parts of France. I mean, this does look forward in a very gloomy way to some of the crimes committed, in my view, in the name of revolutionary democracy in our own century.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the French Revolution, but first we'll take a short break. Historian Simon Chama is my guest. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is historian Simon Chama, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. Do you feel that history is always subjective?
Very good question. I feel it's much more subjective than most historians like to allow. I mean, we've been living now for 100 years under the influence of assuming that history is sort of like a science. In fact, one of my colleagues in France wrote a book a few years ago saying, look, the historians of the future, they're going to be just like technologists. We're going to walk around in white coats, fiddling with computer knobs. We'll have teams of helpers. It was sort of awful, actually, kind of Alphaville, sort of metropolis image of what the historian was doing. But even while it's not gone that far, most historians say, well, you know what you have to do? You have to calm down. Always saying, Sharma, for God's sake, calm down. You know, don't really come close to your subject. Distance, dispassion, objectivity. The historian is supposed to be somebody on a very high mountain, sort of peering through a kind of limpid atmosphere at these sort of mortals scurrying beneath, like little ants, and being able to issue these Olympian judgments about what's going on. I think in the process of writing this book, I came to feel very unhappy with this way in which one comes close to the past. So I've tried actually to push people's noses very close to the history. I mean, I don't know if it works. One can't, of course, run the illusion that you're really reliving in some way the French Revolution. But the first thing I wanted to try and do with this book was really kind of reconstruct a whole world. And there were times, you know, I slept rather badly, I have to tell you, when I was writing this book. And it became a very painful and upsetting thing to do. I mean, people said, you know, oh, I know why you stopped when you did. You know, you didn't have time, you didn't want to deal with the late 90s. And there was a sense in which, you know, I was exhausted. But I think I was sort of getting morally very exhausted by it. And that's why I end the book with places of repose. I mean, I put my characters at the end in places where they can stand or sit still and say, my God, you know, what has happened to us in these last few years? And I was trying to think to myself, well, what has happened to this whole world that I've been dealing with as I've been writing about it?
Do you take a grim view of revolution in general?
Yes, I do, rather. I mean, I think that revolutions promise more than they can deliver by the sheer virtue of the fact that early on in the book, I talk about the revolutionary's obsession with electricity and say that by definition, they of course loved Benjamin Franklin, but then this business about the revolution coming as an electrical storm became very important for them. The way to have true liberty, to have true freedom, is literally like a bolt from the blue. One great transfigurative charge. I mean, it's no accident that Frankenstein is born in the literature of this period, really. One great bolt of electricity, and we will have a new man, a new personality, morally, politically, and so forth. It's the opposite of saying freedom might have to be secured by prosaic, grey, boring, parliamentary, legal means. I mean, one of my heroes of 89 is Madison. I have to say. Madison, in the same year that these tremendous hyperbolic utterances are being articulated in France about new men, Madison is gloomily scratching his quill on his paper and saying, look, it'd be wonderful if we were all very nice and very noble and very altruistic. The fact of the matter is there's always going to be parties. There are always going to be factions. People are always going to claim monopolies of virtue. What we have to do is try and construct a constitution which will let people make these claims without tearing the state apart. In other words, we have to construct a pluralist democracy.
On the anniversary of the French Revolution, do you think we've fallen into hard times for revolution, that revolution is getting a bad name?
Well, I think deservedly so, and I don't mind it, actually, I have to say. I think we're living in through the death throes of the great revolutionary epoch. It's taken 200 years to emerge in some ways from that spell. I mean, in some ways, it strikes me, you know, it's maybe the enthusiasm of a British immigrant to America. I may be too Pollyannish about the American Constitution. But I think with all its ills, it's the American Constitution and to a lesser extent also the British unwritten Constitution with its Bill of Rights in 1689, which has really survived the test of time. If one's touchstone is what kind of political institutions preserve those wonderful axioms enshrined in the Declaration of the Rights of Man, one has to say the American and the British way have seemed to have survived better than the revolutionary way. One irony for me is that France of the Fifth Republic is the revolution that the French Revolution never had. It's the revolution that was lost. Monsieur Mitterrand is exactly the constitutional monarch that France tried briefly to have in 1789 and lost, not only just through the fault of the revolution, but it has to be said through the fault of Louis XVI.
You're talking about America as a model. America had a revolution.
It did, indeed, yes. I'm not, in that sense, against all revolutions, all dramatic changes in political systems. That's why I'm, you know, my heart flies into my throat with excitement, along with everybody else, at what happens in the Tennis Court Oath and what happens in the first part of 89, a spectacle of a political nation managing to free themselves from the captivity of the past is not itself at all to be deplored. It's rather a kind of noble vision. It's when it follows that up with the kind of fetish of unity that I think it goes wrong, when it does not then, as it were, switch from high voltage to low voltage, from the sense of what we're about in a revolution is a community of brothers, of friends, this kind of charismatic attitude towards belonging to a new community and say, well, this has been wonderful, drink of champagne. We now have to sit down with small beer and work out in practice the details of institution which will keep freedom safe. And that seems to me to have been a tremendous difficulty for revolutions, the revolutions of the kind that have happened since the American.
Will you be going to France for Bastille Day?
Well, I'd have to be on the plane now if I were. I'm
yeah,
not
I guess
going to
so.
France.
And,
no, I'm not worried, I think, about being burnt in effigy or being... I've heard that actually there are toy guillotines
really?
Around in Paris.
Oh, well, are there images of you in effigy?
I doubt it very much, actually. But certainly, actually, my some of my colleagues, I think, actually, when my name is mentioned, drown it out with choruses of the Marseillaise. I'm going in December, I think, actually, when I may slip in incognito and hope my notoriety, you know, won't be noticed so much then. There's a wonderful exhibition at the Louvre of Jacques-Louis David, and I'm certainly going to go see that later in the year.
Well, Simon Shum, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Historian Simon Sharma is the author of the new book, Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the background of the current political changes in Poland with New York Times reporter Michael Kaufman. His new book, Mad Dreams, Saving Graces, Poland, A Nation in Conspiracy, charts the rise and fall of Solidarity in the mid-1980s when Kaufman was covering Poland. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Rick Bass's passions include the wilderness, writing, and oil. Coming up, we discuss his new book about his years working as a geologist searching for oil, and we talk about writing that book in his wilderness home. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews From Beirut to Jerusalem, Thomas Friedman's account of his 10 years covering and trying to make sense of the Middle East. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers glitter rock, the bands that survived the fad, and some of the ones that faded without a trace. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News, I'm Doreen McAllister. Several thousand people braved the rain to hear President Bush's remarks today after his arrival in Budapest, Hungary. The president said the United States wants to work with Hungary to continue the changes and reforms the country is going through. Tomorrow, in a speech at Karl Marx University, Mr. Bush is expected to translate into concrete terms the kind of help the United States will extend the country. Better trade terms are expected. State radio is reporting South African police have given prosecutors a report linking black activist Winnie Mandela to the death of a teenager allegedly killed by her bodyguards. NPR's John Madison files this report from Johannesburg.
Eight members of a football team that used to act as bodyguards to Winnie Mandela have already been charged with the murder of Stompie Mokhetsie. But today the police sent a report to senior prosecutors that links her name to the boy's death as well. The police did not say in what way the report links her to the murder. The Attorney General for the Johannesburg area must now decide whether to take any further action. Government critics here are questioning the timing of today's report, since this case has been under investigation for more than 6 months. Only 3 days ago, an official admitted that President P.W. Botha met with Nelson Mandela last week. And attitudes to Mandela's organization, the African National Congress, are playing a large part in the election campaign now underway. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
Former White House aide Oliver North today appealed his conviction in the Iran-Contra scandal. Judge Gerhard Gesell, who sentenced North 6 days ago, agreed to delay the $150,000 fine payment until the final outcome of the case. North didn't request any delay in the community service portion of his sentence. North says he intends to begin assisting an inner-city youth program immediately. North was convicted of aiding and abetting an obstruction of Congress, altering and destroying classified National Security Council documents, and accepting an illegal gratuity. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney says he has a plan that will save taxpayers $30 billion by fiscal year 1993. At a news conference this afternoon at the Pentagon, Cheney outlined his complex plan to overhaul the Pentagon's bureaucracy and tighten control over its massive arms purchasing systems. Cheney says reform is possible, but Congress is going to have to cooperate.
If we're going to be successful in the venture that the president wants us to undertake, it will be in part because we're able to get the Congress of the United States to cooperate in helping us streamline those practices and procedures and structure, help us cut away some of the regulatory burden and underbrush that we now are forced to operate under.
Some Capitol Hill officials were critical of Cheney's plan, saying it doesn't go into enough detail. President Bush requested the report several months ago as part of a major review spurred by the weapons procurement scandal. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up today 11.95 points to 2514.61. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward was listening to the new Bangles album recently. One of the songs has a chorus that goes, "How did we survive the glitter years?" And Ed thought, good question. In fact, many of the people in glitter rock bands didn't survive. They were casualties of drugs and alcohol. Today, Ed listens to the music which he says was a precursor of heavy metal.
In the 70s, the generation that had come of age at Woodstock consolidated its hold on the airwaves and made sure that no music that wasn't a lineal descendant of the 60s made it onto the radio. It was a tough time to be young, a very difficult time in which to rebel. With songs glorifying sex and drugs a commonplace it became very difficult to shock anybody. But it could be done. David Bowie had done his first press tour of America wearing a dress and was happily married to a woman with much shorter hair than his. With an image like that, it hardly mattered to a lot of kids whether his music was any good or not. Just as Bob Dylan had set lyrics free a generation earlier, Bowie set image free. Whether he intended to or not, he gave birth to the movement that's now known as glitter rock or glam rock. It never really bothered the charts much, but it gave the kids of the dark ages of the 70s something to bother their elders with. Bowie was the intellectual figurehead. In Britain, where this music was invented and sold quite well, the mass audience was in love with Slade, four working-class kids from the north of England who'd started out as skinheads but recast themselves as glitter boys, even when their music stayed close to the football chants it was based on. This, in turn, inspired others. For instance, racked up a number of hits in the UK during this time, all of them about as subtle as Little Willie, which got some stateside action, but was the only one of their records to be released here during their prime. No, if you were looking for glitter with some content, you had to stick with David Bowie or seek out the records of a very odd act that once again sold like crazy in the UK, but couldn't get arrested over here.
Riding all out like you were a bird, flying all out like an eagle in a sunbeam, riding all out like you were a bird. Wear a tall hat like the druid in the old days, wear a tall hat and a tattooed gown.
Mark Feld had been all over the mod scene on Carnaby Street as a very young teenager and had gone psychedelic in the late 60s, forming a folk duo called Tyrannosaurus Rex with a bongo drummer named Steve Took. Singing about elves and fairies had its limits, and soon Feld, who called himself Mark Bolan, was back with a different partner, Mickey Finn, a more electric sound and a shorter name, T-Rex.
Songs
like Jeepster and Bang A Gong Get It On, which did go top 10 in the U.S., were bright, catchy, and just weird enough to escape being called bubblegum. Glitter rock was largely a British movement, but a substantial number of American kids made it their own. Its home base here was at Rodney Bingenheimer's English Disco on Sunset Boulevard in L.A., where Rodney, the mayor of the Sunset Strip, played imported British records, rock stars hung out with 15-year-old girls on Quaaludes, and for a while you could forget you lived in the same country as Grand Funk Railroad.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Until a few years ago, Rick Bass was a full-time oil geologist and part-time writer. Now he writes full-time from a log cabin in a remote valley in northern Montana. Bass's first collection of short stories, The Watch, received almost unanimous critical praise. Bass's new book, Oil Notes, is a journal of his experiences working for an oil company. He writes, "Looking for oil is one of the few things in the world that is not governed by paradox. It's consistent, and you can count on it. And in general, a sturdy kind of man or woman does it. You live or die by your own lights. The rules always stay the same, though." I asked him to explain.
Pretty much the rules of physics and of geology have never changed the way rules of anything governed by sociology, rules for, you know, behaving in business or for behaving in even science. These rules change, or these boundaries, but the earth beneath us, it's the same as it's always been, and it's always going to be the same. You drill down and you'll find oil if you do things properly, and you won't find it otherwise.
Yeah, you write that it's thrilling to find oil, that it takes you over, it gets in you, it must be like belonging to a cult. I think I never thought that it would be that exciting.
Oh, it's the most exciting thing that I can imagine. It's unbelievable.
Tell me more about the excitement, because I think people think that the thrill of finding oil has to do with dollars.
Not at all. No, it's just the oil itself. It's like, I mean, that's like, you know, dollars green are so boring, just paper, old wadded up paper that everybody's been handling and dirty and crummy. The oil is never been touched, it's never been seen, it's never been discovered, and you're the first person to find it. It's terribly exciting.
What was your best find?
I think the one I liked the best was one where we and some other companies that were in on the well, we're going to plug it. We thought there was nothing there at first. It was something we hadn't seen before, and we thought there was water down in the rock formations because it had real low resistivity, and yet the what they call the density neutron log was doing something strange that we had not seen it do before, and I was able to talk the company into trying to test it, and it turned out to be a really huge oil well. It was terribly exciting, because not only then was there the excitement of discovering the oil, there was also the excitement of, you know, having saved a reservoir that would have otherwise been plugged and maybe never found.
Do you get a commission on something like that?
I do now, because I'm working for myself. I wasn't then, which was a contention. That was I think it's a lot more fun if you're looking for oil for yourself rather than for someone else. I think it's that way in any business, though.
Mm-hmm. As exciting as it is to find oil, did you ever have an opposite reaction and feel depressed that you would be helping to deplete the remaining oil resources?
Not at all, really. I feel like it's the consumer and I am certainly a consumer, who's helping deplete the resources. The places where I explore for oil, it's in the southeastern United States, which is all private lands, and so the people that are having the wells drilled there have asked for it. I would not want to look for oil on public lands. I would feel, like you say, I wouldn't even have mixed feelings. I would feel poorly about it, because there's people who don't want oil drilling going on their public lands, and certainly that's their prerogative. But no, I never felt that feeling in the Southeast that, you know, the landowners, that's why they gave us the lease, because they wanted us to drill there. Mm-hmm. And
You write that you hate coal.
Oh, I do. I hate coal. It's so dirty. You know, I would rather use, I hate wood. I use wood because I live up way up in the woods, and I don't have any electricity up there, and that's the only way to keep the cabin warm. But wood and coal, it's archaic, and someday oil and gas are going to be archaic, but I think we're going backwards if we use coal. I understand that, you know, that you can use clean coal and scrub it and such, but we're just not going to do that. I don't believe we have the discipline or the to do that. So I think we should just, you know, realize our limits and use oil and gas, which is the cleanest thing we have at present. And then, you know, when we run out of that, we should be developing other sources right now. That's kind of a melancholy or pathos of the industry right now. I think this is like about the last generation of geologists that we'll see in this country, and we'll have to go to other forms of energy in the next generation. And so it's kind of the, you know, a swan song, and that makes it even sweeter looking for oil and gas, knowing that, you know, people, it'll be a lost profession probably in the next generation, if not sooner.
If looking for oil is so exciting to you, how come you left?
To write. Writing is also exciting, and I couldn't do both full-time. And I don't ever want to not be looking for oil and gas. I'll probably work in one or two prospects a year just so that I'm able to stay in it. I keep my maps current, and I stay up with what's going on, but I don't throw myself into it the way that I used to. I try and throw myself into the writing now.
Now, while you were a full-time geologist, you used to drive 36 hours in order to spend 57 hours in the wilderness.
Oh, yeah, even more unbalanced than that. Sometimes I would drive longer to spend shorter times.
Now you actually live in the wilderness.
Yes.
Would you describe where you live?
Sure. It's in the small valley right up on the Canadian line in northwestern Montana. It's heavily timbered. It's like the Pacific Northwest. It's not so much like the Rocky Mountains. It's more northwest. There's extensive logging going on in my valley, which is disturbing, really large clear cuts, but it's kind of like oil. You know, the valley won't be wild forever, but right now it's still pretty wild. There's all kinds of wildlife. We see bear and mountain lions and coyotes and wolves and deer and elk and moose come down in the backyard every day. It's like 100 years ago. It's a nice wild valley for now. The rivers are still clean and pretty.
Is the wilderness as exciting to you now that you're living in it full time, and it's not something out there that you have to go to, you know, take a lot of time to get to?
Yes, I'm glad to say that it is. It's still, every day it just gets better. It's, it becomes more and more important to me, even the longer I'm in it, which is nice. You would suspect or think that, you know, maybe it would dilute or wane, but it just becomes more and more important to me each day.
Do you have an electric typewriter or a computer to write on?
I write in the greenhouse on paper with a pen, but I do have an electric typewriter, which I can run with a generator. And so whenever I have to type what I've written, I'll crank that up and run it for 2 or 3 hours in the evenings.
You have no phone, right?
Right. I've got a radio, but no phone, a shortwave radio that runs off a battery.
How do you communicate with editors, not only your book editors, but you've also over the years written a lot for magazines?
Yes, I really like communicating by mail. I think it's, for me, it's the best way, and it's the most natural way. I think phones and certainly these fax machines now, they're too fast. They demand too quick of a decision. And I think, you know, it's going to sound really old-fashioned, but I think it's almost an insidious thing that, you know, I understand that they're great life-saving technologies sometimes, but also I think we can lean too heavily on that kind of high-speed living and let it alter our lives in a way we may not yet be developed for. So to answer your question, by mail when I can.
Where is the line for you that separates solitude from loneliness?
Boy, I haven't found it in so long. I couldn't answer that right now. I mean, it's a lot farther out there than it used to be. So I guess what I'm saying is solitude is becoming more and more important to me every day. You know, I haven't been lonely, and I don't know when. And, you know, it would take an awful lot of solitude to reach that point, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's so little solitude left anymore.
What's the worst trouble you've been in living in the wilderness?
It's a good question. There was one day that just stands out, very easy to answer. I cut my leg with a chainsaw, and Elizabeth set herself on fire within like 30 minutes of each other.
Gosh.
It was in the winter, and the roads were real bad. It had rained and then frozen, and so the roads were icy. I shouldn't have even been out, but I was down cutting wood, really just to stay warm because it was so cold. And I cut my leg with a chainsaw, not badly, but enough to really scare me. And so I drove on home, and I drove up in the driveway, and Elizabeth's standing out in the snow in her nightgown, and it's charred, it's around her knees or ankles, and she's just standing there in shock with her arms around herself. So she had been standing next to the fire in a cotton nightgown trying to get warm, and a spark had popped through the screen and had it caught her gown. And she saw the reflection at first of the gown in the window and thought it was my headlights driving up, and because it was right at dusk. And then they got larger and larger, and she realized that she's on fire, and she ran out and rolled in the snow. And that was when we said, look, we better shape up and realize where we are and take better care.
What did you do that day? Did you get yourself to a hospital?
No, mine wasn't cut that badly, and her burns weren't that bad. Mostly the burns were on her hands where she'd slapped the fire out. But if either of us had been injured badly, we would have had to go in on the bad road, which, you know, we have chains on our tires, and it could have been done, but it's just better not to do it.
So when you decided you had to realize where you were and get in shape for it, what changes did you make?
Just mental changes. We had prepared for the winter with equipment, you know, having backup generator, backup wood supply, backup saw, backup everything, backup truck even. But mentally, you know, not being tired, just being more alert that things may not always go the way you want them to go.
You know, I think it's a kind of nightmare of some writers that they're going to change their life, leave their job, and get to a place where they can write uninterrupted. And then they're going to get there. Now that they have all this time, they're going to find they can't write.
Did you
ever have that fear yourself?
I think my nightmare is just, I think mine's more broad than that, just that anywhere I am, I would not be able to write. And I think I looked at it, if I weren't writing, well, I would rather be in the wilderness not writing than in a city not writing. So I don't even get that specific with the nightmare. But,
uh-huh.
And I suppose I would be happier. Well, I know I'd be happier not writing here than not writing somewhere else. And I think that's, so I don't worry about that.
Well, Rick Bass, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks very much.
Rick Bass's new book, Oil Notes, is published by Houghton Mifflin. He spoke to us from KUFM in Missoula, Montana. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, how are you continuing to follow the president's trip through Eastern Europe?
We're taking our own tour through Eastern Europe, Terry. We will have a good, substantial piece on today about Hungary and what that country is like now as the president arrives there. And we'll review what happened in Gdansk when the president's last stop on his trip to Poland. We're also going to be taking a look at the abortion law as it affects the state where it was passed in Missouri.
Laurence Olivier died earlier today. How will you be remembering him?
We'll be remembering him by talking to his biographer, listening to some of the great moments of Olivier's acting, which remain with us on film, and we'll be talking to some fellow actors.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The New York Times reporter Thomas Friedman won two Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting on Lebanon and Israel, which he covered from 1979 until this past January. He's now the Times' chief diplomatic correspondent in Washington. In his new book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, Friedman reflects on his time in the Middle East. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
Few foreign correspondents were better prepared, intellectually, to tell the American public what to think about the Middle East than Tom Friedman. Growing up Jewish in Minneapolis, Minnesota, he fell in love with the idea of Israel and summered during his high school years on a kibbutz. As an undergraduate at Brandeis, he studied Arabic language and literature and spent semesters abroad at the American University in Cairo and Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He took a master's degree in the politics and history of the modern Middle East at St. Anthony's, Oxford, an academic hotbed of Arabist studies. He was hired almost immediately by United Press International in 1978, just after the civil war began in Lebanon and just before the Iranian Revolution. A year later, he found himself in Beirut, and 2 years later, the New York Times found him. This was just in the nick of time for a bloodletting in Syria, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the massacres of the Palestinians at Sabra and Shatila, and the suicide bombing of the American embassy and the U.S. Marine barracks, not to mention Tom Friedman's apartment house. At which point, in 1984, after a Pulitzer, the Times decided he was ready for Jerusalem. Viscerally, however, no outsiders ever prepared for the Middle East, for the paranoia and megalomania and despair. From Beirut to Jerusalem is Friedman's account of his tours of duty and his introduction to the major players and his shuffling of American policy options, but it's also a poem of disenchantment. In the desert and in the refugee camps and in the old city with its three gods and sun-crazed prophets and wounded children, he lost his heart. Romance dried up in him. This wasn't the Israel he'd imagined in his Minneapolis synagogue, where the people of the book were writing a new chapter after all the culture and all the libraries in a corrupt Europe had burned down. This was an unholy landscape of mirror images and matching graveyards of Arab and Jew in the intimacy of their violence, an Israel locked in domestic political stalemate, tragically miscalculating in Lebanon, an army of occupation on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, behaving as if the Bible were a deed to all the desert they wanted to cultivate, breaking the hands of the dispossessed who threw the rocks that attracted the TV cameras. A dream killer. Not that Friedman is much admiring of Yasser Arafat, but events insist on reinventing Arafat as the only leader around to talk to about the future of his people. The Intifada, the uprising on the West Bank of Palestinians whose passion for statehood was in a way the creation of Jews, who taught them everything there is to know of homelessness and diaspora, may have had little to do with Arafat, but he was its propaganda beneficiary. And only so long as Palestinians stick to rock-throwing and civil disobedience, passive resistance, says Friedman, will Israelis refrain from massive retaliation, a bloodbath. There will be no peace, he says, until there are two states. And in order for there to be two states, the United States is going to have to be, I quote, a friend, an obstetrician, a grocer, and a son of a bitch. We'll have to break some furniture. Middle East diplomacy, according to Friedman, is a contact sport. Read him and weep.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed From Beirut to Jerusalem by Thomas Friedman. The interviews on Fresh Air are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Michael Kaufman looks at Poland in the 80s and charts the fall and rise of Solidarity. Also, photographer Larry Sultan finds some eternal truths in old and new family photos. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.